Hi, we're going to get started in just 1 minute. If you are looking for a seat, there's a couple seats up front here. And if anyone has their bag on the chair next to them, please remove it, just like the subway or the train. Thank you very much. There's a seat right here. Great, I think we're going to get started now. Thank you, everyone, for coming today to the Tolling for Transit panel. I am Kate Slevin, Senior Vice President of State Programs and Advocacy at Regional Plan Association. RPA's congestion pricing support goes back decades, as many of you know. And beyond congestion pricing for New York City, we have also recommended in the future to put a price on many of the highways in the region that are currently untolled, and to put eventually a price per mile on many roads throughout the region, because our gas tax revenues are dwindling and we're going to need new revenue to supplement those. Congestion pricing in New York City was passed 19 days ago, and already elected officials and various interests are coming out and saying that they have secured or want exemptions to the toll. But of course, there is a $15 billion revenue target, which means around $1 to $1.5 billion in tolls annually in the actual legislation. So every carve-out means that the rest of the drivers pay more. It's very possible congestion pricing will be viewed in a similar way to other pro-environment, pro-health policies in New York City, such as ending smoking in bars or installing bike share. Controversial at first, but after some time and after people see the benefits, pretty popular. But the benefits have to be clear to transit riders and residents throughout the region. There are many perspectives here today, I'm sure, but this is RPA's. Our seas are rising, as you heard this morning, and our transportation systems are already in a state of crisis. We are about to embark on an era for which we are entirely unprepared. Bold strategies like congestion pricing are just the beginning of what we have to do. The details of the New York City congestion pricing plan have not been worked out. There are a few exemptions written into the legislation, such as for people who are making less than $60,000 annually and live in the zone, they'll be given a tax credit. There's a disability exemption, and there's an exemption for emergency vehicles. And also the West Side Highway and FDR are not included. Passenger vehicles will also only pay once per day, for example. But a panel called the Traffic Mobility Panel will make recommendations that will advise on the rest of the details of the proposal, including when it's going to be in effect, how it's going to be implemented, where the tolls, what other tax credits or toll exemptions there are going to be, if any. And then the MTA will approve a plan sometime in late 2020. Congestion pricing will not start until 2021. And while New York City works to implement the program, there is a robust dialogue also going on in Connecticut about implementing tolls on highways, and so we're eager to hear more about that today. And of course, New Jersey is facing its own challenges in paying for transportation projects and service. And New Jersey residents, if they drive into Manhattan, they already pay a form of congestion pricing. Their tolls on the Port Authority crossings are lower if you pay Easy Pass during less congested times and higher during congested times. That is a broader form of congestion pricing. And across the country, cities are watching us. Over the past few weeks, I've spoken to organizations in Seattle, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area. They're all hoping that we do it right in New York City, and so whatever we do makes these new ideas more palatable in their neighborhoods and their communities. So the panel has a lot to say, I'm sure, on this topic, and we're lucky to have such a great group. I'm just going to introduce everyone briefly. For longer bios for everyone, you can look in your program book. Moving left to right, we have Midori Valdivia, who's the chief of staff to the MTA president and has also had roles at the Port Authority and TLC. We have Polly Trottenberg, New York City DOT Transportation Commissioner, who spent 25 years in public service, both at the local and national levels. We have Robert Rodriguez, who's the assembly member for the 68th District in East Harlem and an early and strong supporter of congestion pricing in New York City. We have Connecticut State Senator Alex Bergstein, who's the vice chair of the Transportation Committee and the first woman in 88 years to serve Connecticut's 36th District. And we have Andrew Salzberg, head of transportation policy and research at Uber. Thank you all for being here today. Is this on? Okay, great. Midori, I want to start with you, since your agency and the DOT will be working together to implement this program. Can you talk a little bit about where you're at, what the MTA is thinking about, sort of the day-to-day in terms of implementing congestion pricing at this point?
Okay, thank you, and thanks to everybody for having me today, especially the RPA. So I think the first comment I want to make, and Kate was talking about this, this is such a transformative moment for the MTA. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Thanks so much. So this is such a transformative moment for the MTA. You know, three Fridays ago, my boss, Pat Foy, the chairman of the MTA, likes to say, MTA has $0 towards its capital plan, its new capital plan, the 2020 to 2024 capital plan, and now we're looking at $32 billion, a combination of congestion pricing revenue, internet sales tax, new revenue stream from real estate taxes, what some call the mansion tax, and as well as certain assumptions that we're making about federal government funding. So right now, what we're doing is really laying the groundwork for an implementation plan, and we're working closely with the city DOT on that. We're thinking about infrastructure approaches. We're thinking about timelines. Kate talked about 2021. 2021 is just around the corner. So we're really thinking about what it will take to set up a tolling infrastructure system, all of the technology that we want to implement. Right now we have EasyPass, RFID. And so we're also thinking to the future about how to make the system ready for the future, too, if we just want to use RFID, if we want to think about other technology as well. And just this week, we actually issued a request for expressions of interest for the building of the congestion pricing technology, which is now called the Central Business District Tolling Program, according to the budget legislation. So I want to be accurate in my use there. So that's what we're doing. We're working daily, part of the legislative framework, kind of mandated for the MTA and the city DOT to work in partnership together to come up with an MOU, essentially a rules of the road of how this will work from a planning perspective, from a design perspective, and from an implementation perspective. So we have a lot to do. Another thing that we're starting to really think about is what does day one of congestion pricing look like for us? And so that will require us to do, you know, a lot of modeling in partnership with city DOT to think about, you know, what does the mode shift look like? And how do we think about all of the improvement plans that we have already in the works and how to make them even more robust to get ready?
Thank you. Polly, so you're working jointly with the MTA. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the legislation lays out in terms of your cooperation? Because I think that's a really important point that you'll be advancing this together. And then talk a little bit about some of your concerns that you're trying to work through now and will be over the next 20 months.
Right. And does this, yeah, this, okay, mic is on, just the light isn't on. So I think Midori did a nice job of laying out sort of the first steps are for the city and the MTA to work through what is really the very brass tacks infrastructure pieces, technology, and then from the city point of view, how are we installing it on our streets and working with the local affected communities and integrating it into all the existing infrastructure. As I think a lot of you know, there's a lot of infrastructure on the streets in Midtown Manhattan. So I think those are sort of the very technical questions. Along with that also goes working together on all the appropriate federal approvals, which we expect we will need. And then I think for the city, there's sort of two other steps, being part of both through the review panel, and I just think in general, the discussion of the design of the system and the policy questions. How does it work? Who's exempt? You know, how do we ensure that we raise that revenue? While making sure we have tolls at a level everybody can live with and then work mm-hmm. through the exemption questions. That is going to be, I think, a very complicated and lively debate, and I already see people in the room who I know are going to be very engaged in that. The city will be as well. And then I think, as Midori said, what happens on day one, and then I think for the city, what continues to happen. As we've learned from London, for example, a city we talk to a lot, They did a lot of, as Maduri used the word, transformational. It's transformational for the MTA. It could be very transformational for the city as well. Starting to, you know, imagine what does, you know, half of Manhattan look like if we really can reduce congestion. We can really transform the bus system, enhance our bike lanes, pedestrian space. You know, in London, they've seen air quality improve. They've seen roadway safety improve. So I think for us, there are a lot of exciting things the city is going to want to be working on right away with the MTA to get ready for day one, but also longer-term plans if congestion pricing really is successful.
Thank you, Polly. And I think it's worth noting one statistic that we've cited a lot, but is really important and we don't talk about enough, even though we've started talking about it more, is that in Stockholm, asthma rates dropped 50% after the implementation of congestion pricing for children around the zone. And, you know, I think that's incredibly important and something that does not get enough attention in this discussion. Robert, I want to move to you as a longtime champion of congestion pricing. You're actually the sponsor of the original Move New York legislation, which laid out a lot of the ideas that were in the Move New York plan. What changed this year in the legislature? And can you talk a little bit about how the discussions were different?
It's always helpful to have the governor and the mayor agree on something together. I would say that is one of the single biggest influencers that certainly changed the tone and the direction of the conversation. But I think as as that support came in, a lot of the discussions had to shift to what is a potential political reality around what are we delivering in terms of our constituents. And that's always a question that each legislator asks themselves when they're considering big policy is, what are we doing differently? How is this going to make the lives of our constituents better or worse? What's the value that's actually coming out of this conversation? And certainly there's the credibility issues that we had to address, which is why a lot of the legislation that either originated with Move New York and eventually came here had some fundamental discussions about MTA. How is this going to operate differently? How is MTA going to have tools to either do design build and potentially align it so that we feel like this investment is being appropriately spent and delivers the value there, but then also that it focuses in areas. If we are saying that people should leave their cars at home and migrate to mass transit, that there's something for those people who don't live in the Central Business District or even in Manhattan, an area that I represent, that it actually delivers something of great importance to people who live in the outer boroughs, be it Queens or Brooklyn, that these areas that we term transit deserts, where you need two buses to get to a train or live a couple miles from the nearest subway stop, or don't even have any subway stops in your particular district but rely heavily on bus service, how do we improve that so that people see some sort of benefit for what is going to be a transformational change there? And that's really what happened over the course of this year, is really digging into what do people in these transit deserts need to be able to leave their cars and migrate to the mass transit system and better utilize what's out there, if it's a Long Island Railroad connector or a Metro North connector, or if you're just heavily reliant on buses. So a discussion around how do we really deal with the transit desert issue and there be some benefit for those constituents there. So it was a long dialogue, particularly around transit desert funding that we had put in place initially last year, but really digging into the granularity of how we can really address either in the capital plan or separately some of the transit desert conversations. And then, dealing with a lot of the counter-arguments to this proposal and putting forward a plan that can demonstrate the improvements. For example, when we talk about congestion, ongoing debate about how much congestion is this going to alleviate. And I think it is important for us to say, we should be tracking this, we should study this. If it's 15%, it's still 15% better than where we are today, but put in a mechanism to really look at that. And it was mentioned in the earlier session, and again here, the environmental impact. I mean, I represent East Harlem, the area with the highest asthma rates in the city in Upper Manhattan, and being able to measure tangibly the environmental benefit. So that this is not just a story about how to raise revenue for a system in crisis, but also there are other goals and laudable objectives that we hope to and expect to achieve as a result of the plan, and actually proving them out over the course of time. So, you know, digging into a lot of those things, either as point counterpoints to, you know, to some of the objections, but then also saying, you know, those are not all without merit. We should spend our dollars better. We should see the benefits, you know, to our environment. We should see the benefits to the transit system. Those need to be measured. And if we're going to, you know, essentially, you know, raise $15 billion worth of money to invest in a system that we know needs it, but is still not necessarily meeting the full needs of the city in places like that have transit deserts.
Thank you. And the legislation does lay out some requirements for performance metrics and tracking of the implementation and of traffic, right, that you will both be monitoring?
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Alex, I want to move on to you. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the dialogue in Connecticut and sort of where you are on implementing tolls there.
Yes, I'd be happy to. First, I just want to tell everyone that the 36th district that I represent, we are your immediate neighbors. So we are Greenwich, Stanford, and New Canaan. And just one point of correction, I'm the first woman ever to represent it and the first Democrat in 88 years.
Thank you for the clarification. Sorry about that.
But I'm really not about party. I'm about seizing the opportunity to advance good solutions. And believe it or not, Connecticut is the only state on the East Coast that doesn't have tolls. Mm-hmm. So we can't even begin to talk about congestion pricing until we implement a tolling system. So that is the debate going on right now. And it's a heated debate. I think it hasn't really been framed well. I think people don't fully understand what the cost of not having tolls is. Of course, nobody wants to pay more for something they think they're getting for free. But it's not for free. The cost of not having a tolling system is failing economy, failing bridges. Eventually, it's going to mean failing schools because the money for transportation has to come from someplace. And if we're restricting it to our general obligation fund, there's not enough for everything to go around. So we've done an excellent job neglecting our infrastructure for 40 years, and now we really have to stand up and do the right thing and implement a tolling system. So I was the first legislator to put forth a bill for tolls. Now we have three bills. They're being condensed into one on the highways like 95, 84. I don't know if this means anything to you, but basically on the major highways. And we're getting much closer to a resolution. And the other thing that people don't really understand, but we're trying to make the point clearly, is that because Connecticut used to have tolls up until about 20-something years ago. And then, you know, there were all kinds of problems, and there was a really horrific accident, and tolls were eliminated. So people either remember what tolls used to be, which was pretty horrible, and especially from Greenwich, because we were a border town, and the trucks used to back up, and there was horrible, you know, diesel exhaust, and trucks would get off and travel our back roads. That obviously doesn't exist anymore. It would be all electronic. And everybody knows time is money. So trucks who are paid by time of delivery are not going to get off the highways. Everybody's going to go the fastest way possible from point A to point B. So this is really the only way that we can create the foundation, the infrastructure foundation, to accelerate our economy and economic growth and bring jobs and revenue back to the state. So that's really, it's really a comprehensive solution to something that's been it's become a crisis and we can no longer avoid it. So just to give you a few quick stats, we have over 300 failing bridges in Connecticut. And about 30 years ago, a bridge in Greenwich, the Mayanus River Bridge, failed. 7 people died. This is a real life or death issue when you have 300 bridges that could go at any moment. We have the 49th worst infrastructure in the country, and we have the fourth highest cost per mile of truck congestion. So the reason those statistics are important, I think, is because they illustrate how we are hurting ourselves. We are impinging our own ability to move goods back and forth, which is the basis for our economy and for people getting jobs. And we can't continue this and expect a different result. So right now, the dialogue in Connecticut is basically everybody agrees that, yes, we have terrible infrastructure. Everybody agrees we need to fix it. The debate is really now focused on how are we going to finance it. And one, the only other option on the table is just to issue more bonds, which is just issuing more debt. And Connecticut already has the highest debt per capita of any state in the nation. What it would take would be $10.5 trillion of new debt. So we could do that option, which I think is a terrible idea. Or we could implement tolls, which is a user fee. Everybody pays their fair share with all sorts of reductions for, for in-state. Maybe we can do a reduction for low-income families. I'd really like to do that, and I've been told it's possible. But also the best part about tolls is that at least 40%, maybe even over 50% of the total bill would be paid for by you guys. The non-Connecticut residents. Because somewhere between 30 and 40% of the traffic on our highways is from out of state. So I thank you in advance for your generous contribution. But, that's what we do, obviously, when we drive through New York, is we pay our fair share so you can maintain your roads. So it's an equitable solution. It's the smart and responsible and fiscally responsible solution. So I'm hoping we're going to get it done in this session.
Great. And has there been talk about whether the money would come back to just the highways or also to the public transportation system?
Yeah, we needed to come back to the public transportation system, specifically to the rail system.
So both.
Between New Haven and New York, because that's really our economic engine. But that's apparently a negotiation you have with the feds.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Andrew, I want to move on to you now. A lot of people in New York especially have said that for-hire vehicles are contributing to the growth in traffic congestion. If you look at the stats, it's pretty clear. But you've been strong supporters of congestion pricing. Can you explain a little bit about why and how this fits into what Uber is trying to do?
Yeah, sure. And I appreciate you guys at RPA having me here. It's a great panel. It's obviously an interesting topic. We've got wall-to-wall people standing in this small room. So I think the most basic and most tactical thing I could say is that ultimately congestion is not good for our business. Right? It doesn't actually benefit Uber. I always sort of read some stories that have this theme that runs through them as though we're sort of secretly out there to cause increasing congestion, like it's part of our big strategic plan. I can assure you that it's not. I think ultimately it's harder for drivers. It's certainly less of an experience for the riders that we're serving, that congested roadways are certainly harder for us to operate on. So while it may be a byproduct of some of our operations, it's certainly not something we want to see. So at the most basic level, anything that is targeted at managing congestion in sensible, thoughtful ways, of which congestion pricing is probably the most well-known, is something we support. And I think it's a nice place that we find a ton of agreement with people who are not always on the same page as Uber. We've got groups from labor advocates, environmentalists working alongside us here. We've been big supporters specifically of the most recent passage of the bill in Albany and elsewhere, using both financial and other support that we have to help get it passed. So we are big fans, not just sort of passively supporting it, but kind of actively getting in the trenches and trying to make it happen. So we're excited for that reason, but I think that's only one of them. I think the broader one, we've been working on helping finance transit in places beyond New York. So we've supported things like sales tax referendums for transit funding in places like Florida or Atlanta or Seattle. So it's not a one-off adventure here in New York that we're supporting ways to find and fund better transit. And I think that may be counterintuitive for some people, because I think the narrative is often that an Uber ride that you choose to take may be competing with transit. I think there's a way in which that's certainly true, and it's good to acknowledge. The story often gets told that we are competing and winning. I like to tell the story that when the Second Avenue subway opened, thanks to Polly's agency, we have good data on it, the Second Avenue subway took riders out of taxis and Ubers. So I think there's a counter story there, the good transit. And I think some of the bus lane work that was announced just recently, all of that is places that are better, faster, cheaper than a car ride, and that's good. So we see people actually choosing transit over Uber in a lot of scenarios. But I think more important than that is that while there may be at an individual trip level a sense of competition, at an aggregate level, we 100% work together. People do not abandon their personal car and replace their trip volume with Uber rides. We see people who take Uber are disproportionately higher users of transit across the country. People tend to use Uber for a couple rides a month, maybe. They don't use it every day to commute. So they definitely work together, and I think our best markets are actually places that have the best transit. So from a longer-term perspective, if we can find places that can actually fund and build high-quality transit, we see our business actually thriving in those places. We have to be careful how we manage that interaction, but at the most basic level, good transit and good Uber if I look across the country, I see those markets actually happening in the same places. They're not at odds. And last but not least, I'll say I think one of the really interesting things about this round of congestion pricing is that, you know, the core idea is if you're tolling cars, you change people's behavior, and ideally they move out of cars. That's the most important effect we're looking for. But there's a side benefit here where you may actually have, and New York's a good example of having four or five different companies operating sort of app-based services through cars, of which many are shared, right? Not just ours, but some of our competitors. And so in the past, the results were a lot about less car traffic overall. I think you might also now get better car traffic for the remaining cars on the road. So even if we cut, you know, 20% of the cars off the road, what we would like to see is that whatever car is on the road is shared and has as many people as possible in the vehicle. So I actually think there's an additional benefit to congestion pricing, that you create a market not just for less cars, but for better car traffic on the road. And that's the sort of, that's a societal benefit. For us, you know, we want to compete in that marketplace and build a better shared car product to move more people in the cars that we have. So I think there's kind of layers of benefit of congestion overall is not a good thing for us. Better transit actually is better for us in the long run. I think they work together. And finally, there's a really interesting marketplace that gets created where every vehicle mile is charged. That encourages efficiency in market for how you actually use that car space.
In any of the cities you're working in, have you mapped out how much reduction in some of the policies you're promoting would, what the result would be?
Not in great detail. I think in practice what, you know, I think that obviously the goal is to reduce the car miles traveled in Manhattan. There may be a countervailing effect where we can see if we can do better at having lower price points and kind of winning more of the market. You know, I think you could have less cars and more shared cars as a percentage would probably be a win, but I haven't seen any detailed math on that.
I want to move back to talking a little bit about things that you're already doing at the agencies to prepare for congestion pricing. One of the biggest concerns we heard was that there wouldn't be the ability to get better transit in place by the time congestion pricing was implemented. And I know you had a great announcement yesterday, Polly, about pedestrianizing certain streets in Lower Manhattan, about improving bus speeds. And I know the MTA is doing a redesign of all of the bus networks in all the boroughs. You're currently in Queens, right?
Yes, but we're still working on the Bronx.
Okay. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that and how you've been working together to get to ensure that there's better service in place before congestion pricing is turned on?
I mean, I think the two agencies' efforts on improving bus service actually happily predate congestion pricing. Mm-hmm. We have seen the trends here in the city, and it's not just New York. It's happening in cities around the country, but bus ridership has been going down pretty dramatically. There's a combination of factors. I have to disagree with my colleague from Uber a little bit. I think Uber and the for-hire vehicles have been a factor in that, but certainly congestion has been a big factor as well. I think failure to sort of keep up with some of the more modern technologies and amenities of bus services. So the two agencies have been working very closely on that. You know, for many years we did select bus service, but I think with President Andy Byford, now both the MTA and I'm proud to say the mayor in a couple of initiatives have put forward, I think, some really bold steps to continue to really turn around the decline in bus ridership here. A lot more dedicated lanes, much better technology, transit signal priority. You know, in New York City, one thing we started to hear loud and clear was frustration there wasn't enough enforcement in the bus lanes. We now have seven teams going, working with the MTA, finding the lines where we're seeing the most obstructions. They are even towing a lot of vehicles as well as writing summonses. We're both working together to install more cameras, both in bus lanes, and the MTA is going to be installing them on buses. So we recognize now, though, with congestion pricing coming, not only does this give us the opportunity to improve bus service in the core, but we do want to make sure, as Assemblymember Rodriguez mentioned, that we're going to have better bus service from those further away parts of the city, where if we're admittedly making it more expensive to drive, we want to make sure people have really good transit options.
And I think in addition to the great bus work that our teams are working on, I think we also can't forget that we have a 2015-2019 capital plan underway, in which right now 23 stations are actually undergoing accessibility improvements right now. And this is on top of the commitments that we want to make in the 2020 to 2024 plan. So there's a lot of things underway. You know, by 2020, we're going to purchase 500 additional buses. So there's a lot of good stuff underway. And so now it's about kind of coordinating and making sure the timing makes a lot of sense for, you know, what I'm calling day one. But, you know, we have seen ridership decline, not just in buses, but at certain times of day and on weekends and subways. And there's, you know, real reasons why. And I think what you've seen Andy Byford do, president of New York City Transit, is kind of do an all-out full campaign internally to better performance, to fix the things that we need to fix. You know, he calls it back to basics. It's also part of that subway action plan that we all work together on to, you know, clean drains, you know, fix track defects. You know, we see less track fires now. That's a good thing. And, you know, I can't believe I have to say we see less track fires now. But I think all of those things we're doing on a daily basis to improve service, and our goal is to provide a real viable alternative transit service. And I think I really appreciate what Assemblyman Rodriguez said about specifically in the outer boroughs. We have to really focus on that, and we heard that loud and clear in Albany. And, you know, we have to follow through on those kind of commitments as well.
Great. Assemblymember, do you think your colleagues in Albany know what the MTA and the DRT are up to?
They do now. Well, mostly because, Pathway had been a tremendous resource throughout this conversation. I think, you know, in fairness to him, he was up every single week during the budget process, literally with his team, really taking account for, you know, not just the issues or neglect that may have happened in the transit deserts in the past, but really listening almost on a granular level. You know, we had sidebars with folks who were in Brooklyn and Queens to talk about, you know, some of their issues, to really dig into the the heart of the matter, which is that, you know, places do not have, you know, the level of access that they needed. And I think, you know, that made a difference, not just listening, but also the commitment towards really changing that, you know, both financially and as well as the capital plan and the language around that in the bill, saying, you know, it is one of the main priorities right after signals, right? It's in that level of investment and priority for the MTA that made that difference. So being able to do that, I think, is what really highlighted, the ability to move that part forward.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we heard over and over again is just this sort of distrust with the MTA. Do you see that changing at all? That, I mean, from our perspective, you know, the Fast Forward plan, Andy Byford, Pat Midori, other people.
Just a comment on that. I think they brought a significant amount of credibility to the conversation. I think Andy Byford and the work around Fast Forward and the Subway Action Plan. And, you know, if we hadn't seen some tangible result from the Subway Action Plan, I think we would be in a very different place. But having seen the improvements from just last year to here, and then understanding that we could not do Fast Forward unless we took some significant action to be able to bolster revenues. And then, yes, having enough confidence in Andy Byford and his resume and the fact that he was able to meet and put together a plan, you know, in a few months after getting here, I think at least put a base level of confidence in their ability to execute. And then we put all the stuff in legislation to make sure that it actually happened. Because I think, you know, we believe that Andy and his team is going to be there for the next 20 years. But in the event that they're not, you know, we wanted to make sure that there are, metrics, measurability, accountability. And the governor certainly feels the same way based on, you know, some of the recommendations that he put in place in terms of board accountability to be able to move that forward. But I think it was really important for them to demonstrate a plan and then also be able to tailor and adjust their priorities to not just be about Fast Forward, but to be about, you know, the broader transit system and the connectivity for those folks who are a little bit further away, but who will rely on the system more than they ever have as a result of the plan.
And if I may, I'm really glad that you brought up the point about credibility because, you know, I've been at the MTA for a year, maybe about 4 months, and, you know, we did spend a lot of time in Albany in this budget cycle. And to me, of course, you know, we hear about the credibility gap. We hear about the fact that, you know, customers have lost faith in us. And, you know, I believe them. I think it was really powerful for the chairman of the MTA, or, you know, he was the MTA president at the time, to sit there in the room and to really hear from elected officials day in and day out about what's going on out there, out in the field, out with customers daily. And that's something that Pat, I know, really cares about, restoring that credibility, making sure that whenever New York City Transit, the commuter railroads, all of these organizations and these, parts of the MTA family are making commitments about, delivery timelines for construction projects. When we're talking about how we're going to improve service in a certain area, we have to follow through, right? And so what's also another part of the transformative nature of congestion pricing, the Central Business District tolling program, sorry about that. I think what's transformative about that is it really creates this like transparent accountability mechanism, right? It says to the MTA, we have to deliver. And I think our senior leadership team is really excited to step up to that challenge.
Great. RPA has been very interested in MTA reform, and a lot of the recommendations we put in our fourth regional plan we released a year and a half ago are similar to the ones in Fast Forward and are things we've, talked with you that you're starting to implement. It just is taking time. Mm-hmm. It takes time to turn a ship around, right? Andrew, I want to go back to you and talk a little bit about your experience because you work nationally. What's sort of your vision at Uber for, and can you, if you can talk a little bit specifically about how the role technology plays in this, what's sort of your vision for how people will be able to get around cities in the next 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think the big thing were, obviously it was change. If I was here a year ago, we wouldn't have any meaningful sense of ways to move around that are not a car available through Uber. And I think what's been exciting, we acquired Jump, which used to be called Social Bicycles, which is a Brooklyn-based dockless bike share company, so excited to have brought them in to the family globally. We've been launching some of their services in Europe, but most prominently so far in the U.S. So I think that's one big part, is that we now have a few dozen places with pedal assist electric bikes and scooters as well. And I think really interestingly, it's not just the plan is not for that to be a niche bit of the business. I think there's a really meaningful way in which many, many, many places, including the core of the biggest cities, which is sort of our key markets in many places around the world, it's much faster and cheaper to get around, certainly by pedal assist electric bikes. I live in San Francisco. I reluctantly had to move out of New York a couple years ago because my employer forced me to. I'd much rather be back here. But while there, the weather is good all year round, and you can bike faster than certainly driving or transit in many cases. You can take a bike across town. There are a lot of hills, but the pedal assist aspect actually really helps get over that. And we've seen, even within our own platform, many riders switching away from taking what they used to take an Uber car ride for to a bike ride for. So I think that's a big part. In a place like Sacramento, where we have a relatively large allotment of pedal assist electric bikes, we actually do more rides on bikes than cars in the zone where bikes are available. So that's a relatively limited part of the city. We'd love to see it bigger. But that's actually a place where that's not a future vision. We are now greater than 50% bike rides on the platform in one market. Now, hopefully that'll be more markets in the future. But I think that's another way to go back to your question about why congestion pricing. We have no attachment to moving you in a car. That's certainly, if you're in New York, that's the dominant way you experience Uber, no doubt. But I think elsewhere in the world, it's already the case that that is less the dominant way of getting around through the platform. And just a few months ago in Denver, we announced we're going to have transit ticketing through the Uber app. So there's lots and lots of places where it's faster and or cheaper to take a transit ride. We don't want to offer a different way. We just want to make it easier for you to get on that. So I think the real vision is that there's not a particular mode of transport we're attached to. I actually think the real power of all this smartphone stuff is that you can choose the right mode of travel for the exact trip. Whereas before, if you took your car in the morning to work and you parked it there, you were sort of obligated to bring it home with you, even if when you're leaving the office it's a particularly congested road. So one of the really good things we're trying to do is enable a ton of choices through the app. And I actually think there's a really meaningful sense in which that makes tools like congestion pricing more powerful. Because a toll doesn't mean that much if you have no option other than driving your car. You're just stuck paying for a toll and getting angry about it. If you have multiple options, you can mix and match at the right time and the right place, which is what we're trying to build. There's a clear way in which I think more behavioral incentives like tolling work better and better the more alternatives you have, whether it's a shared car or a bike or a transit trip or whatever it might be. So I think that those two visions to me go together really well, where we want to build a great place for a lot of transport options, and I think there's a whole broader imperative to do pricing and tolling.
Are you all looking at bikes to implement more bikes before congestion pricing starts? Is that something you're looking at?
I mean, absolutely. I think some folks in this room probably know we announced at the end of last year that we're going to be, over the next 5 years, both tripling our docked bike share system, which is now in a big chunk of Manhattan and out into Brooklyn and Queens. We're going to see how quickly we can get it further up into the Bronx and further into those other boroughs. We are also we ran this summer, and Jump Bikes participated a pilot with the dockless technology, which I think we think may work better in sort of further out parts of the city. We did it in Staten Island, up in the Fordham area of the Bronx and out on the Rockaways, and it was wildly popular. So we're also talking about what the next phase of expanding that might look like. And I agree with one thing Andrew's saying. It is certainly true. Our data shows if you are trying to get somewhere in Midtown Manhattan, you will be faster on a bike than you will in a car. Now, maybe after congestion pricing, we'll see what that looks like. But at the moment, that is definitely true.
Great. I want to talk a little bit about the exemption discussion, because I think that's going to be something that we are all engaged in the next 20 months. And I was really glad that Alex said that, you know, come to our state and pay our new tolls, because, and we'll pay tolls when we're in your state, because I think that's a nice way of looking at it. And we've heard from New Jersey that they want to be exempt from certain tolls. And I think one thing that's been missing is sort of a regional perspective, that we are all kind of in this together and we move around the region in a much more than our transportation agencies are set up to acknowledge, I think. So I think that's important to realize. So I appreciate you said that. But the New Jersey has, then Governor Murphy has said that they would like some of the revenue from the tolls to go back into NJ Transit and to PATH. Now, previous proposals for congestion pricing have actually given toll credits to the Lincoln and Holland Tunnel, and I'm sure that will be part of the discussion, and I'm sure the GW will as well. What do you make of that? And please, anyone can answer this question, because I think it's a broader question than just New Jersey. It's a question of how do we balance out all these regional needs in this discussion that is, you know, in New York City.
I'll jump in. Just, it was interesting. I heard, Alex say, here in New York, you're collecting those tolls to fix your roads. Just, I mean, I think an interesting thing that a lot of the people in this room know, that's not actually what we do with the tolls we collect. The city roads don't receive any toll revenues. A lot of the toll revenue that's collected in this region goes to our PATH system and to sort of other parts of Port Authority operations, and then on the MTA side to fund, obviously, our subway and bus system and commuter rail. So, there are a lot of complicated questions. I think, congestion pricing very much raises this question I know many people in this room have thought about, which is there's the question of who pays, and then there's also a question of the externalities that your driving causes. As someone who sort of helps to manage the roadway network in New York City, I hear a lot about the externalities, the congestion, the air quality, the roadway safety sort of issues that the cars pouring in and driving around the city create, and in the wear and tear on the infrastructure. So I think it's a tough question, but one we will have to grapple with in the next 20 months. How do you align that to the extent that you're a user and you're sort of contributing to those externalities? How do we make a fair system where you're sort of paying an appropriate amount to cover, what's happening and to fund the transit systems? And I mean, for what it's worth, I think New Jersey, yes, their transit system needs investment too. I don't know how we will solve that problem in the long run, but I don't disagree with the contention that obviously New Jersey Transit has suffered from some years of disinvestment.
Right. Anyone else want to tackle that one?
Sure. I'll just add that. So in our specific situation in Connecticut, because we're trying to reinstate tolls, the federal agreement is that we can only do it if we use it to reduce congestion, and the monies have to be used on the same corridor where the revenue is generated. So I'm sorry if I misspoke, but that's what I meant to say earlier. We have, to your point, Kate, we really do have to see ourselves as part of a larger ecosystem, an economic ecosystem and a transit ecosystem, and that's really a big lift in Connecticut, because we're, a state of 169 fiefdoms, and breaking through that ideology that somehow, we're all better off separately, and that, it only matters what comes back to our district or what's in it for me. That sort of individual, what's the payback, the immediate payback for me, that mentality, we have to do away with that, because we really all are interconnected in terms of our economic growth, our future, our security, et cetera. So that is that's part of the case that we're making. I think people are starting to understand it. I am also, you know, to your point about credits before, another way to frame this is that, you know, congestion pricing and tolling is really the free market solution to transportation. You don't want to use the highways. There's better, if there's transit is better or Uber is better, then use that. This gives consumers the choice. If we have differential pricing and different times of day and different categories of, you know, commuters may get a discount, low-income families hopefully will get a discount, then consumers can choose the option that fits them best. And I like that idea as opposed to, you know, sort of a flat tax on everybody.
And just to follow that up, that was a conversation that happened. I mean, there, you know, as we settled on congestion pricing, there was ongoing discussions about what about a gas tax, what about a bump in sales tax, and all of those are tools in the toolbox. But this is the one that made the most sense because it is user driven, and I think that same conversation is going to happen around exemptions. You know, when we recognize that the more exemptions that you have, the higher the ultimate fee is going to be for us. And as somebody, you know, who will be traveling to New Jersey this weekend and often goes through Connecticut to visit my in-laws in Maine, we are very much interconnected. And, you know, and once you make that decision, you know, those costs and contributing to be able to fix the roads in Jersey on the way down or paying my share on the way up to Maine, it all matters. And we are regional in that respect. And I think trying to, you know, create a dialogue or a dynamic where, you know, it's New Jersey and Connecticut and people are being exclusive, we all rely on that for our daily activities, be it work or be it family or be it general travel. And I think, you know, in a perfect world, the federal government would be helping us more. somewhere. But I think part of that conversation is like we are recognizing that we are a little bit on our own in how fund our immediate needs. And have to put in, you know, a substantial amount of the seed investment to be able to even talk to them about some sort of aid. So I think that's where some of those dynamics about helping out and that regionalization or that the feeling that, you know, we've got to figure it out on our own. However, we are interconnected as a region.
Yeah, may I just make one last point, because I'd be interested to know what the data from New York shows, but in Massachusetts, the constituency that fails to pay their Easy Pass bill in Massachusetts are Connecticut residents. So more Connecticut residents are not paying their Easy Pass in Massachusetts than anywhere else. So I wonder if that's also true in New York, since we're your neighbors.
Well, it's certainly all the out-of-state drivers who are. It's harder to sort of claw the penalties back.
But
for
it
them.
Would be.
I think Pennsylvania might be.
In your best, so certainly in Massachusetts' best interest, and maybe even in your best interest too, to advocate in Connecticut that we should have tolls, because then everyone would have the transponder and we'd pay our fair share.
Great. Thank you. And RPA has been very vocal in support, and we will continue that.
Thank you.
So I want to open it up for questions from the audience right now. I'm sure people have some thoughts, questions.
Please wait for the mic.
The mic is coming up. 1 minute.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for participating. For my Dory, my name is Neil Weissman, cycling advocate. Mm-hmm. Question, MTA has got 7 bridges and linking some very important real estate. What portion of congestion pricing will go to making those bridges bike accessible? Because right now, none of them are. This is the Rockaways, this is Riverdale to Manhattan, the Triborough Bridge. Some of them are cheap, some of them are very expensive. Does the MTA have a constructive position on this?
No, I think that's a really good question. As I understand the legislation right now, the Central Business District Tolling Program revenue will be going into a capital lockbox, and that capital lockbox is specifically for 80% going to New York City Transit, the subways and bus systems, and 10% for Long Island Railroad and 10% for Metro North. So Assemblyman Rodriguez, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's been kind of what's in the statute right now. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't sound like right now there's funding for going back specifically for this purpose, but I think that's something that, you know, knowing that cycling is becoming ever more popular, it's, you know, something to look at.
In the back, Mike?
Yeah, I can probably be, okay. Thank you. I was in Europe last week, and I read about and heard about the London now has a second toll, and it's for a smaller part of the central business district, and it's a toll that varies based upon emissions levels of the vehicles. And I'd be curious about, to go into that, in fact, if you have a very high emissions diesel vehicle, that toll at 24 hours a day could be as high as 60 pounds. So I'm curious as to your comments about adjusting tolling based, you know, given what we heard this morning about emissions and given what Kate said about asthma, I'm curious about your thoughts on adjusting tolling based upon the type of vehicle emissions or level of vehicle emissions.
I mean, I think I'll jump in here. Others can too. It's certainly an issue. We're familiar with what London and other cities have done, either through tolling or just creating, for example, low emission truck zones or zero emission truck zones where only those trucks can park and load. And it's something certainly that the city has looked at the moment, at least at the city level, how we would, in a sort of an enforcement scheme, be able to distinguish those vehicles has proved a little complicated. I think in this 20-month debate, that is certainly something that is, I think, going to be hotly debated about whether those kinds of vehicles will receive special considerations, discounts. I will say one lesson we did hear from London, you know, do be careful about all the exemptions you start to give out. Mm-hmm. You know, look at the long-term, if you're doing one on vehicles, look at the long-term trends on vehicles so that you're not completely eroding the revenue, you know, you want to give to the subway system.
Right, and we have a lot of tolled facilities already in the region, so that right there provides a model that you can work off of, right?
And just to chime in, you know, one of the benefits of working globally is we see a lot of regulatory systems in 65 countries around the world, including London. So we've been big fans of the ULEZ zone that you're talking about. I think it's a smart way to sort of drive behavior change. And one of the things that's been talked about a lot, totally independent of Uber, is that there's an overlap between trying to electrify, you know, ground transportation and individual vehicles and shared networks and maybe ultimately autonomous vehicles. Because if you bring down the number of cars required, even if the miles stay the same, you have kind of less cars to switch to electric or lower polluting. So that's something that we're excited about, where the potential of just the transition to a more of a shared fleet actually helps the electrification problem at the high level. At the very specific short-term level, the real problem in London is that the charging networks don't exist to support, you know, 50,000 Uber or other private hire vehicles, as they call them there, to actually be electric. So we've done a bunch of studies in terms of how you might design a charging network for shared fleets, how you might work with drivers. One of the big things is the upfront cost of a lower emission vehicle is higher. They might not have the capital in the short term. So we actually have a fee right now that we're self-imposing on rides in London that goes into a pot for drivers to upgrade to electric cars. So I think there's a really nice, as I was talking about earlier, overlap between lower emission vehicles, electric vehicles, and shared vehicles. So London, I think, is a great example. We've got a lot of work going on the ground there to help make that transition.
I'm going to go all the way to the back. And then to Combo, next.
Yeah. How do you ensure that the government authorities, Metro North, MTA, et cetera, and you're getting this increase in revenue, how do you assure that just using this, not in a way to give an excuse not to increase their revenue? So all of a sudden they're getting 10% in Metro North. Oh, I'm getting 10%, therefore I don't have to really raise any more money. How do you ensure that, shouldn't there be like a, if you're giving 10% to this or 80% to the MTA, that your requirement is also a proportional increase of government funding in those entities in addition to this funding? Or is this just an excuse to reduce the burden to the MTA and Metro North, et cetera?
I mean,
how do we assure that?
I think I can give at least one answer. I think as the assembly member said, the mayor and the governor came together on this, and some of you can look up, they came up with a 10-point plan. And it actually did address that issue. It did say that even with the new revenues of congestion pricing, the MTA is on a regular schedule of fare increases, not popular, but sort of a way for the riders to contribute. And I think it also speaks to, you know, expecting in the city and the state to also continue their contributions. I think everyone agrees this money is supposed to be additive. It's not supposed to substitute for all the existing revenue sources that are put together with, you know, a fair amount of, I think, political pain, but very necessary. I don't know. Assembly member, if that's
yeah, right. And it doesn't remove previous investments. I think even in statute last year when we funded the Subway Action Plan, those are real dollars that were committed to, you know, in terms of an agreement with the city and the state and an obligation. So it doesn't. So there are certain obligatory, you know, investments that cannot be taken away. But I think also the spirit of it is to really make dramatic improvements and, you know, not to lessen the investment in some of the other areas. And I think, you know, that's part of the audit mechanisms that were put in place, where reporting on actual dollars spent and the financial audit that was built into the legislation, both before and during the capital investments, to kind of make sure that no one's pulling back on what we expect to be a new investment on improvements and expansion. So I think, you know, all those things are things that we require be reported on regularly, because we were concerned about the transparency elements around that and making sure that MTA is ultimately accountable for continuing to invest and expanding the investment level.
Tecumbo, you're next.
This is a question.
It's in the back. He has the microphone, so thank you.
Yeah. Question from Dorian and Polly. I guess, given the short time frame to congestion pricing and really giving an alternative to folks who are in some of the transit deserts, it seems like the only real alternative to rapidly increase access, other than, for example, the new stops for Metro North and Long Island Railroad within the city, that's kind of existing access, just making city fares available, but would be real BRT. It's much easier and faster to implement than other subway, and that's something that requires real coordination between the city and the MTA. Are there plans to really advance that, to fast-track that, so when you come to day one, there actually are alternatives other than just paying the toll for folks who live in places where there aren't access to subways?
I mean, I think as we were saying, and again, we've been working with the MTA on sort of the city's version of BRT, which is select bus service, pretty aggressively. And it's interesting. I think there was a point where the MTA was sort of feeling a financial pinch and, you know, was sort of talking about how much would we continue with that. I think now we're going full speed ahead. We're looking at a lot of routes, and I think we will be working particularly with our state colleagues to make sure. I mean, we heard, as Midority said, I know she heard up in Albany, you know, Southeast Queens, there are key parts of the city where we know there is a real need of greater bus service. I think we're going to have to work hard. I mean, 2 years is not a lot of time.
Right.
But I think we have a strong commitment from both agencies. I know we have it from the mayor and the governor, and I think our legislative partners. So, you know, and you all will hold us accountable, I think, for trying to get as much good bus service going as we can in the next couple of years.
Right. And I think it's also, and Polly's absolutely right, I think one of the things that folks want to do is, like, let's just add more buses. Well, actually, our outer borough areas or corridors are also still heavily congested. So I think these kind of targeted improvements that we're making will be really valuable, and I think you'll see, you know, some of those service improvements upcoming.
Well, and I will just add, some of you should, I mean, the mayor did an announcement yesterday.
Yes.
He announced, for example, 24 different routes where the city, in some cases working with the MTA, where we're doing a lot of targeted things that we can do quickly to improve the routes, to, you know, some of the things are pretty simple, but they can have a big impact on bus travel time. So we're doing, I think, all the quick things we can think of, and then the deeper planning.
I have time for two more questions. I'll do go to Larry, and then the woman in the back.
It sounded like we heard some cautious support for revenue sharing with NJ Transit and PATH specifically. How would that happen? It sounds like it might have to be a legislative solution.
I don't think there was any support.
I think we may have to go back to the drawing board for that one.
Empathetic. Yeah. We all want more money for New Jersey Transit and PATH.
So how do we make that happen?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. I'm an advocate by nature, and I think one of the great things I saw during congestion pricing was a huge coalition coming together and saying that we need more investment in transit, and here's a variety of reasons why. It was private companies, so private business in New Jersey could step up and work with us. Some of the community-based organizations, the environmental groups, I think we all have a stake in that. So I think that's what RPA is going to be pursuing. I don't know if anyone else has other answers to that question, but I think there needs to be a stronger voice for more transit funding in the state of New Jersey, absolutely.
So I believe this is the last question. My name is Caroline Varian, and my question is for the senator. Firstly, thank you for all the work that you're doing in Greenwich and beyond. Who do you view are the sort of largest opponents to tolling? Is it individual residents, or is it businesses with large fleets? Second part of that question is, for those of us who support you, from both being a resident myself and being involved with business, what would you recommend that we do to support your efforts?
Thank you so much for that question. Yes, that was a perfect question. And let's talk more afterwards, but I'll just quickly say that the concept of a user fee is actually originally a Republican idea. So the fact that this issue has been politicized and it's become a completely partisan issue right down the line, I sit on the Transportation Committee, vice chair, you know, sat through the public hearings, and the final vote literally went down party lines. So that's really unfortunate because it means that that we're putting party politics in front of good solutions that are really going to advance all of us, the state entirely. And that's... So I would say the real opposition is the opposing party that wants us to fail, even at the cost of the state. So, and you can tell that because they have organized from the top down, and this is their singular issue, and they're talking about it all the time, and they're doing forums throughout the state, which are really just, you know, one-sided forums in which they talk about facts that are not facts, and our side unfortunately has not organized to that. And in fact, to the point where I actually was at an event last night with some of my other legislators, and I'm always talking to them about tolls and the importance of it. And they said, "Oh yeah, we support it, but we're not going to go talk about it in public because Alex, you're doing that. You're taking the heat for us." And I thought, that's the problem with politics, is that everybody's playing their own game and avoiding the, you know, the difficult solutions to the complex problems because they're just thinking about, how am I going to get elected next time? I don't care about that. I didn't go into politics for that reason. I went into politics because there are good solutions that we're not seizing because of this sort of cyclical two-year, four-year cycle and because of partisanship. So... let's talk afterwards because there are a lot of things we can do to coordinate messaging and really to reframe the issue so that everybody understands it's in all of our best interests to do this. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Let's give a round of applause for our panelists. That concludes this session, and we'll be reconvening in the ballroom upstairs in just a few minutes for lunch. Thank you, everyone.